going. Okay, so tonight is the 8th in the series, January 21st, 20th, January 20th, January 20th, 8th lecture, and we're going to be talking about Tzfat tonight. A lot's going to happen now in Tzfat. Again, the entire world has changed, and like within the past 50 years, So in the past 50 years, again, since 1492, 1497, the entire Jewish world has been turned over. And then, not only that, that's in the West, but in the East, how's it been turned over? It's been turned over with the Ottoman Empire, the expanding Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire is conquering. In a certain respect, the Ottoman Empire is good for the Jews. The Jews are fully accepted, they're fully appreciated, and that's the place for Jews to be. And what ends up happening in all this is in 1518, the Ottomans conquer Eretz Yisrael. In 1518, they conquered Eretz Yisrael, and they and what happened is then the Sultan dies, and then the next one is Suleiman. So there was a rebellion after after the Sultan died. I forgot his name. His name will come to me, and then Suleiman the Magnificent. Put down the rebellion, as Muslim rulers know how to. Puts his own governors in charge and ends up conquering Egypt as well. So, starting in the 1520s, Israel, all of Palestine starts to become under the Ottoman Empire, and all the advantages of what was in the Ottoman Empire. Is all going to be, that's it, is now extended into Eretz Yisrael. There was one city, Sfat, that ended up becoming like the center of the area. That was like the, I think one more. Pick one more, I think. That one, I think, yeah. So the Sfat ends up becoming the center of the administrative the administrative center for the Ottomans, and it also becomes, lots of Jews are going to move there, especially from the exiles of 1492, 1497, and again, as we saw from Portugal, afterwards, the Jews kept trickling out, and they found their ways to Eretz Yisrael. Just about a little bit of a history of Sfat. So let's go back from the beginning. The Sfat is not mentioned any time in the Torah. It's not mentioned. So we're just starting with the very history of Sfat. We just had the introduction. So Sfat, going back in history, is not mentioned anywhere in Tanakh. But it is the first time we really come across it is actually two places. One is Rebbe Elazar HaKalir, and when he brings the kinnis of Tisha B'Av, it seems that in the city of Sfat, it was the Kohanim family, the family of Yakim or Pashchor, one of those two families. Some say Yakim, the family of Yakim, and some say Pashchor. There were 24 Kohanim families. And each one had to do service in the Beis HaMikdash two weeks a year, right? So that's how it worked out. Everybody was on call for Yom Tovim, but 2 weeks a year, that was your week, each of the 24 families. And there were also 24 families of Levites, and Yisraelim were also, we were all also broken down into 24 families. And twice a year for a week, we all had to, they all did their service. So the first time it's mentioned in Sfat is mentioned in by Rebbe Elazar HaKalir about the Kohanim of Sfat. The other time it's mentioned around the same time is by Josephus. It seems that Josephus was, when he writes about what he did, so he was, Josephus originally was put in charge of the forces in the Galil to fight against the Romans. What happened is originally there was a rebellion against the Romans. The last governor of that the Romans had over the area was very, very, very bad against the Jews, and the Jews finally had enough, and they rebelled against him. And then Herod, who was the one of the descendants of Herod, but Agrippa, but he was in the Galil, he sent in a force, and they destroyed that force. And the Jews realized now that they had just started a rebellion. This is in the second base of Megdash. They started a rebellion against Rome. And they knew it was just a matter of time. Rome just was trying to get themselves together. And Rome, one of the disadvantages Rome had is that it was very slow getting their armies from place to place. In terms of there was no, you know, basically their armies had to walk. Had to get there by walking. Maybe they got there by boat, by ships. You know, so they did that as well. But basically, so when they had to decide to fight the base of Mikdash, they had to get their armies there. So they had months. They had a few months to prepare, knowing that the Romans were coming after them. So Josephus was put in charge of the army in the Galil, and he was in charge of setting up. And they started a. They wanted to have a fortification of a whole bunch of a string of cities, and that would be the wall of defense. And it didn't work out so well. One city of Dafat, I think it was, they surrendered to the Romans, and the Romans had a policy: if you surrender to us, we don't kill you out. If you don't surrender and you fight, then that's it. All bets are off. No promises. So Yodafat was one of the big cities. They just opened the doors to the Romans. They said, look, that's it. We surrender. We're not part of the rebellion. That was Yodafat. Now, Josephus was in one of the other cities. I forgot which one.
Yodafat. Yodafat.
I don't remember which one. It wasn't Yodafat. Yodafat. Okay, I don't remember which one, but the story with Josephus was that he realized it was lost, case was lost, and he said, all right, let's all kill ourselves rather than having to be given over to the Romans, and they drew lots who would kill who, and he ended up that he was the last one, and he didn't kill himself, and he surrendered to Vespasian, and he offered his services to them, and they took it. And he was the one that ended up writing these books. He was the historian of the day. He claims that he, because he was where he was, he made things better for the Jews. And the Jews said, nope, you're a traitor. And he said, he's not a traitor.
No,
and
it's Yodfat. It's
Yodfat. Yodfat. Yes. Yodfat was the city? That's where they killed.
That he was fortifying and holding.
Aha. Uh-huh. So then Yodafat was that
they
city.
They didn't open. They said they were fighting until it was possible.
Okay, then I guess it was another big city that surrendered. It was one big city, and that made a hole in the wall. Mm-hmm. That's how they ended up breaking through. And they just picked off city by city. And that's really what the Romans ended up doing.
The Torah wall, they were critical of him one day.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, again, do we really know? You know, but you're right. There, the verdict is out. Is he?
A bigger number.
Yeah. Right. Most people are critical of him. You know, he wrote these unbelievable works, Contra, Wars. It's all been played with, and but even after all of the. Rewriting of it. It's still an unbelievable work. Gives us a tremendous sense of history. And one of his things he brings down is that he One of the fortification cities was Saf or Safad. That was the that had its fortification, and that's Josephus writes it in War of Jews, Book 2, Chapter 20. That's where this is. Okay, Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah the, in Yerushalayim, the Talmud, by another time that Safad is mentioned is that in the first base of Mikdash, up through, well, really the first base of Mikdash, they didn't need it. But in the second base of Mikdash, in the very beginning, you know, when they did the new moon, right, and they decided which day is Rosh Chodesh. Is it a 29-day month or is it a 30-day month? So you had to decide, you know, how did Bezin decide? Witnesses would have to come and they'd have to say they saw the new moon. When they saw the new moon, they testified, and Bezin with Paskin, this month is a 29, this is a 30. So how did they let the people know? Now, at that point in the second base of Mikdash, it was a very sizable Jewish community in Bavel. It could be even most of the Jews were in Bavel. So the Jews in Bavel also have to know when Pesach is, when Sukkot is, how would they know? So in the very beginning, they came up with this great system. And the system was in a system of 10 mountains, they were able to reach Bavel in one night. In other words, one night you had one mountain, and then they would have these fires, and they would move the fires in a certain way. And then the next mountain, they were waiting for it. Is there going to be fires or not? If there was fires, they knew it was Rosh Chodesh. If not, not. And the second mountain, I believe, Sfat, the mountain of Sfat, was either the second or the third mountain to get it. And then that made its way north, and then the mountain started going to the east.
Are
then
you
they
counting the first one of Yerushalayim
huh?
one? Number one Yerushalayim in this?
Yeah, number one would have been, I'm not sure if it was Harzesim or Hatzofit, huh?
One of those, yeah, but that's number one.
That was number
so
one.
So really there were nine more to go after.
Correct. Okay. Right, so there was nine more to go. But Sfat was one of those mountains. And because of the Tzedukim, they had to stop it. The Tzedukim, when they came about, the Tzedukim believed in Tarsha Baal Peh, B'Ksav, and not Tarsha Baal Peh. And like, because of Torah Shebiksav, the Torah that's written, so like, for example, you want to follow what's written. One example of it, it says, Umimachras HaShabbos, the day after Shabbos, you'll bring the Omer. So it says Machras HaShabbos. And we know it's not Machras HaShabbos, it's the Machras, the first day of Pesach. It's the second day. Machras really, well, why is it Shabbos? That's a different discussion. But we know that Machras HaShabbos, you bring the Omer, is really the Machras, the first day of Pesach. But if Pesach comes in, but if you're reading it literally, it's the day after Shabbos. So the Tzedukim weren't too happy with that, right? Because if it's the Machras on Tuesday, it's
how
not...
How was it done when it was... the Tzedukim were the priests...
The Tzedukim, I mean, after yesterday there were many in the priest class were Tzedukim, but still the Chachamim ran the show. Right, so we ran the show. So what they wanted to do is like they once were found playing with the fires, because if they made it this way, then Pesach would come out on Shabbos. That's what they wanted, the first day of Pesach to come out on Shabbos. Then they're happy, because Machras HaShabbos is Sunday, that's when you're supposed to bring it. So when they started playing around with the fires, the Rosh Chachamim said this is not a reliable way, and then they ended up having to send witnesses, and that's why today, basically, we have two-day Yontif, right? Because you couldn't reach a certain amount in time, and they weren't sure which day Yontif was, and therefore they couldn't find out within by the time Yontif was if it was a one or two-day Yontif, and that's why Yom Tovim is 2 days. We are out in Gullis, and why do we do it now? Minhag V'Seinu B'Yodeinu. Okay, so that's another thing. But here, the Gemara in Yerushalmi is asking, you know, they used to, in Sfat anyway, they used to make the bonfires. Why would they make a bonfire in order to because of the Simcha of Rosh Chodesh. But, you know, should they do it? They abolish the fires. So Zeri asked the Rebbe, those who see the bonfires in Tzfat are allowed to light their own bonfires in turn to publicize the new moon has been declared. Ah, he replied, the rabbis abolished the practice of bonfires. Then why does Tzfat light bonfires? Because of their knowledge that the new moon has been declared, they light in celebration. For they know when it's been declared, they're in close proximity of the Beis Din. And as Yishalmi and Rosh Hashanah, that's probably after the destruction. I'm not sure when this was, but it could very well have been after the destruction, when the Beis Din was in the Galil, when it was either in, you know, Usha or one of the places, Tveria. These are places were nearby that it was there. I'm guessing that's when this Gemara was. Okay, let's moving right along. There's a lot of things, but about Tzfat, but I guess we then go into the 12th century. Tzfat was a fortified city in the Crusaders' kingdom of Jerusalem. Jerusalem there were four kingdoms. One of the kingdoms was Jerusalem. It just wasn't Jerusalem, the city, but it was the area was called Jerusalem. Included in Jerusalem was all the way in the north, the Galil, and all around. And they built a castle there. I guess Knights Templar, these were very, very strong warriors. The Knights Templar were famous, strong fighters and warriors. And they built a castle there, and it was kept there by them since 1168. In 1096 is when they started, and 1160, it's now about 67 years later, there was a Crusaders' fortress. Now, there probably were not so many Jews there because Benjamin of Tudela. Benjamin of Tudela in 1170 made his world-famous trip. He traveled the world, and wherever he went, he used to write about the Jewish communities all over the world. Scholars for history have been studying his diary, so to speak. And he made it all his way. I think he made it into, I don't know if he made it to China, but he made it all the way even into India, Persia.
Huh?
I have
it.
And you have his book.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and it's fascinating. Some of the things that the Jews were doing and what he describes. And but he does not mention any Jews in Tzfat at the time. You know, and that's something, if there would have been a significant Jewish community, then he would have made some mention. In 1187, there was a battle. The Crusaders did something. They overstepped their bounds, and they attacked some Muslim wife of a sultan or something. They broke some sort of a truce. And as a result, Saladin, who is the leader, whether you call it the sultan in Egypt at the time, so he went ahead and came up and attacked the Crusaders. He recaptured Jerusalem, and then there was this very, very big famous battle by the Huns of Chitim in 1187. So the Crusades left Jerusalem in the hot Mideast sun, traveled from there, walked 10-15 miles, 20 miles, and then they were expected to go ahead and fight the Muslims with about 100 pounds of armor on them. They didn't stand a chance, and they were wiped out basically. And after they were wiped out, Saladin captured a lot. That was pretty much it. They lost a lot during that battle. That sparked the Third Crusade. That's the famous one with Richard the Lionhearted. And Saladin, Richard the Lionhearted, had it out for a bit. You know, they were famous stories about the two. Richard Lionhearted lost his horse in the middle of battle, so Saladin sent somebody to give him another horse. Richard Lionhearted offered Saladin his sister for as a shidduch, maybe to be some sort of an alliance. It's just crazy things between the two. So Richard Lionhearted was not able to get back Yerushalayim, but he did reconquer, he conquered Akko, he maintained along the coast, he maintained a crusader empire, at least close to the coast. But one of the things is that when he captured Safat, so the Christians that were there, you know, you see the Muslims in those days were much more civilized than the Christians. When the Christians conquered Jerusalem, they killed everybody there that wasn't Christian. So it says the blood was up to their knees. And like here, when Saladin recaptured Safat, so he allowed the all the Christians to relocate to Tyre, to go back. He let them leave. Shmuel ben Shimshon visited the town in 1210, mentions that there was a community there. There was a very, very big tzaddik that moved there. His name is Rav Tzaddik. He was originally Rashiv in Gaon Yaakov, which was in Bavel, and he had moved to Sfat. Okay, just this Tach Kamoni writes about him, how he was Nebuch. He had to leave Bavel, and he was in a bad situation, but he's still a tzaddik. That's basically okay. In 1227, the fortress, the Muslims go ahead and they destroy the fortress in Sfat because they want to prevent. They destroy all the walls because the Crusades, that's how they protected themselves. They protected themselves by building these fortresses all over. So when the Muslims got in 1227, they decided to destroy the fortress in Sfat. In 1240, this is I think this was like the seventh Crusade. This Theobald I of Navarre, I don't know how to say it, Navarre. From Navarre was in northern Spain, I think it was, or southern France. And basically he brought a crusade, he brought a whole bunch of people to fight. And it almost like seems that without too much fighting, he won a lot of land. At the time, the Mamluks that were in Egypt were at big odds with the Mamluks that were in Syria. And they were really going at it. And I guess he came in at the right time. And like he made some sort of a treaty, and he ended up with land. He got Yerushalayim back, and he got Sfat, and he goes ahead and he rebuilds in 1240. I think he builds the wall again in Sfat. He stays only for about a year and a half because I think he realized there's too much infighting, and he didn't need all this, and he left. And by 12, within about 6 years, I think it is. Anyway, this is, if you get an idea of this is what the, what it looked like, what he, 1229, these were the Crusader states. And in 1241, they conquered just a little bit more. And he ended up with Sfat. By 1260, that's it. There were no other Crusades. There was nothing left of the Crusades. There was nothing left of them. But he had conquered Sfat, and when he conquered Sfat, he rebuilt the walls. And then, in 1260, came the Mamluk Sultan Baybars, also a famous sultan. He reconquers Sfat. He reconquers, I think, Akko as well. Oh, he was upset with the Christians, with the Crusades, because they were making a pact with the Mongols. See, the Mongols came to the area, and they were making a treaty, so that was it. He said, that's it, no more Mr. Nice Guy, and he attacked the Crusades, and he conquered many of them. He conquered Sfat. So even though on the coast, in Akko, when he conquered Akko, he destroyed the walls, the fortifications, so they can't reset up. But in Sfat, he decided to leave it up. At least at that time, because it was a good place for him to make a defense. The Crusades would come from the coast. That's where they would have to come from with boats. And Sfat was much inland. So that he figured that he left on. Okay. This is, by the way, the Mongols did make some sort of an invasion, but they never really got in close. They All right, this was some sort of an invasion in 1258. It wasn't, it didn't, they didn't last too long. Strategic value, okay. And, okay, the Sfat then becomes the head of the area in terms of for the Muslims. Now, 1286, now we're just going with the Jews. So from that time on, it seems that when the Muslims retook Sfat, there was a Jewish presence there. In 1286, there was a Shlomo Petit that we had that he was causing a controversy. His controversy was the same controversy that was happening in Europe he brought to the Middle East, and that was the Rambam's works. He said, no, we shouldn't learn Rambam because of the Moreh Nevuchim, because of his reliance on Aristotle, and, you know, it's one thing in Europe to do it, but I mean, this is the Rambam's like home court advantage. Like, you know, the Rambam was here. The Rambam's buried in Tveria. Rambam passed through, you know, Eretz Yisrael. I mean, he lived in Egypt. This is his, like, you know. And anyway, they came very, very down strongly against Rav Shlomo Petit, and they put him in Cherem, and that was. But that, and again, that was in the year 1286 in Sfat. It's moving just ahead into the 16th century, which is what we're going to be focusing on the next for the rest of today and next week and maybe even the week after, and that is in the 1500s. So with the world in turmoil, this is where Sfat is going to be a major center for Jews and for scholarship, halacha, Kabbalah. Just everything. It's going to be just the place to be, and like so many great people in such a small place at the same time. As you can see over here, Isaac Luria, which is the Ari, Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, Yosef Cairo, which is the Shulchan Aruch, and Kabbalah. Shlomo Levi Alkabaz, which is a Kabbalah, that's the Lachadodi, and others. We're going to look. We may get to Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. That's who with the who was the probably the leading scholar at the time who lived there. Just as somebody who just from people who were there, this is a David de Rossi, merchant from Cesena. Italy, came to settle in Eretz Yisrael in 1535. So he writes, he who saw Sfat 10 years ago and observes it now has the impression of a miracle, for more Jews are arriving here continually and the tailoring trade grows daily. I've been told that more than 15,000 suits have been manufactured in Sfat during this year, besides fancy suits. Every man, every woman who works woolen fabric earns an abundant living. Hatred of the Jews is, and just unbelievable what he says here, hatred of the Jews is, in contrast to our homeland, unknown here. The Turks hold the Jews in esteem in this country and in Egypt. Jews are the chief officers, administrators of the customs. No injuries are perpetrated against them in the whole empire. Only this year, in consequence of the extraordinary expenditures caused by the war against Persia, some things never change, right? War against Iran, you know, were Jews asked to make advances of loans to the princes. They needed money to fund the war. Also something's ever changed. All articles of commerce are available in these countries. Fibers, spun and unspun, are exported from Sfat in great quantities. Oil, honey, small quantities of silk. From other countries, we get all kinds of spices, such as pepper, muscat nuts, ginger, and cane spices. Many people among the most Jews buy these goods for selling. Some merchants trade for Jews in exchange in the amounts of over 10,000 in the wholesale business. Again, things never change also. He writes, my dear wife Sarah, since she's come to Sfat, has recovered with the help of Hashem. For the water and air here are unusually good. Only few illnesses occur here. Therefore, unbelievable what he says here, medical art does not flourish, and the physicians do not earn much money. In Israel, that also hasn't changed that much. Sick people eat bigger, small cucumbers, gourds, many kinds of fruits, and this is a letter written. Okay, this is an idea of what 1535 he's writing. It's During the early Ottoman Empire, 1525 to 1526, they have on the records 633 Muslim families and 232 Jewish families. I guess, how much is in a Jewish family? What do we average, about five, six? So that would be about 1,000 Jews at the time. A Hebrew printing press.
Huh? At that point in time, people had more children than that.
Could be. Could be. I mean, there's also more infant mortality. I don't know what the average is, but when they say families, what do they mean? Do they mean, I'm guessing an average of five. You know, if you have one family with one or two, you need 10, 11 to make it get it back to five. So.
Well, if there's a family, it's a famulus.
Hmm?
If there's a family, it's a clans.
Clans, yeah, okay.
A clan can have a lot of people.
Sure. So I guess, but that's how it's recorded. 232 Jewish families, 16 military families. I don't know what that means. Oh, that's not necessarily Jewish families. Okay. A Hebrew printing press was established in 1577 by Eliezer Ashkenazi in 1584. So this is 50 years later, 32 synagogues registered in town. 32. So you got to realize each synagogue needs at least 10, right? So that's 320 men. Probably 320 families. Oh, that's all right. Probably a lot more than 10 each family in each synagogue, but okay. Just going further, Sfat was the capital of the Sfat Sanjak, which encompassed the Galilee, extended to the Mediterranean coast. In 1549, Sultan Suleiman, a wall was constructed in 1549. 1520, Suleiman recaptured. Again, if they recaptured. In other words, the previous sultan had captured Israel at the time, and then they rebelled when he died before Suleiman got himself together. And in 1520, he recaptured it. In 1549, the walls were constructed. So the walls you see today around the old city of Jerusalem were the walls built by Suleiman the Magnificent, in 1549. 1553 to 1554, the population consisted of 1,121 Muslim households and 716 Jewish households, right? And then we saw before in 1584, 32 synagogues. So I'm assuming that they had more than 716 times five, I guess, is 3,000 Jews at this point. And then, you know, maybe more. Okay. This is a tshuva. Now, some of the shilas and tshuvas. So this is a tshuva written by Rav Yosef Cairo in his Avkas Rochel. So what happened is there was somebody, a person by the name of, let's see his name here, person came from Berlin, and he decided, up until the way it always has been in Sfat is that the poll tax was not the anybody sitting and learning, Talmidei Chachamim, did not pay the poll tax, and neither did the very poor. What's a poll tax? A poll tax was for the Ottoman Empire. Every single person had to pay, you know, every community had to pay a certain amount for every person in their community. So like when they registered, that's I think how we know the registers. So when you register 716 Jewish households, so that's fine. That means for every household or every person has to be paid X amount of money. So it was always that the Talmidei Chachamim didn't have to pay and very, very poor people didn't have to pay. So somebody came, maybe we'll see in the next slide, I forgot his name, but he came from Berlin and he said, what's going on here? What do you mean Talmidei Chachamim don't pay? That's ridiculous. And he convinced the heads of the families to that everybody should pay. Poor, not poor, Talmidei Chachamim, everybody should have to pay. And then when the Talmidei Chachamim got wind of this, they spoke some sense back into the leaders of the community. They gave back some of the money that they had taken, and they went back to the way it was. And he writes that the heads of the community of the city decided to impose burden of taxation. This was originally, we warned them not to do it. It was never done since the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. And then they finally agreed to They agreed with the rabbis and they returned the monies, but then they wrote, Rabbi Yossi Kaira wrote that in order that it doesn't write again, we hereby make an excommunication to all those that violate this, and the curse of the Torah before such a person, fine. And you see, it was signed by Rabbi Yossi Kaira, Rabbi Yisrael Meir de Karel, the Mabit, Moshe Ben Yossi Trani, okay, etc. Okay, so that's now this is the same thing, but from the Chuvas Mabit, who was around the same time also, big Talmud Chacham and a Kabbalist. All the Torah scholars who had not paid taxes until now, they leave their homes for a short time. Just an idea on how what they used to do. In order to just oversee their work, which others are doing on their behalf, is being faithfully executed, as to provide their food and other needs, so they don't have to rely on other afterwards without wasting any time. They immediately return to the study of Torah. The non-learning time they spend is strictly enough to provide their needs, so they don't have to be supported by the community, but not to become wealthy. It is therefore fitting that the leaders of the city, not to alter the boundaries that were fixed by the Chachamim, and they learn from the Torah to the exemption of Torah scholars from all forms of taxation. And that's what he says, that should be done. Same time, same, just both from the Beis Yosef and the Mabit. Yom Tov Tzalon, he's reminiscing in his tshuvas, he's a little later. He says, I remember when I was young, the city of Hashem was filled with all manner of praise, wealth, and honor. The great elderly and holy rabbis, Rabbi Yosef Kaira, Rabbi Yisrael Kuriel, Rabbi Moshe of Trani, and, just brings back what he remembers. This is Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. This is Mabit again. So what was Mabit? He writes in this tshuva, very interesting. He was in charge that many people were moving to Spot. And you have a lot of, where do you put your houses? Like today, you have plots and various things on, but see, he was in charge of that. I guess if you go now, it's unbelievable spot. It's all built along the side of a mountain, And so I guess, where you, if you're people coming in, they want to build a house at a certain area, it has to be. It can't be encroaching on somebody else's house. You have to be, in terms of sinias and all that stuff and everything else. So he writes, since the days of my youth from the year 1521, I took a leadership role in Tzfat. In all matters dealing with the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael, I've any questions that have been posed to me, I'm able to respond to all that of the Sephardic Jews who came to Sfat to request of me. Hashem has inspired me to rebuild the ruins of Sfat, and I supervise the great building activity so that no one encroaches upon the boundaries of another. I adjudicate all of the distribution of lands as well as the invasion of privacy and blocking of light that come about through building on adjacent lots. During all these years, as the different communities with their distinctive native tongues separated and built shuls, we were involved in enacting ordinances for all the communities. These ordinances mandated all new immigrants who originated from the Turkish Empire as well from other countries to attach themselves solely to the synagogue of their respective communities. In other words, if you have poor people coming from Poland, they got to go to the Polish synagogue. If you have poor people coming from Salonika, they got to go to the Salonika. If they have poor people coming from Spain or Portugal, they got to go to the Spain or Portugal synagogue. Why? So that if they're poor, you'll be taken care of by that community. And if you have money, they have where to collect money from to support the poor. Again, this was at a time. It was a very wealthy community at the time. Even still, you had people that were poor. But this was like the. It was a very, very golden age, I guess, of Sfat. He says, because of the Sfatim exiles of Spain, this is the Mabit, again, the 1520s, 1530s, because the Sfatim of the exiles of Spain formed the majority of the Sfat community, they needed two synagogues. One was not enough, So one was called Kal Gadol, Kal Yaakov. It was originally a unified collection distribution for both synagogues. But afterwards, because of differences of opinions, they ended up with their own collection, each one. They decided how to distribute. We instituted any Sephardic Jew. Now what happens? The Sephardic Jew, they're making their way out of Spain, of Portugal. So which shul do they go to? So I think they made up a whole system, right? They said you could freely join the synagogue of your choice and that no synagogue can infringe upon the other. Every year, it seems that the Mabit and the Chachamim would jointly sign a letter addressed to all the holy congregations of the city to help support the indigent of the city, of the communities. Because of this, money comes in every year for all of the poor. Not only do they have money from there, but from the diaspora, from Europe, from Salonika, that area, Asia Minor, the rest of the Ottoman Empire, that all was brought in. In addition, this also spurs wealthy to come and give special donations. Okay, in other words, I guess if people see that there's a system to take care of the poor, so they have an address who to send the money to, and they know that the money is going to be spent well, as opposed to just, you know, who do I send the money to, and people pocketing it. So when you, I guess, the Mabit felt that coming out with that letters and showing that we're working on it, we have a system, and everybody's being taken care of. Oh, some people would give, though they know their money is going to good causes. Another chuvas of the Mabit. We gather together to see the breaches. So here two very interesting shilas started to come about. One of the shilas was, what do they do about the gifts of the Kohanim, right? The Matanas Kohanim, about the Zroa, the leg, the jaw, the keva, the foreleg, the cheek, which are all part of the, you know, these parts of the animal should be given to the Kohanim. So I guess you also have a few issues. How do you know who the Kohen is? Kohanim have to be able to prove that they're really Kohanim in order to get it. But what's happening is the butchers were just taking it and keeping it for themselves. So he says that what they did is a lot of the practice continued until what happened? Did they do? So they made it that the butchers, I see fit decreeing, befitting to decree upon the butchers that they not sell the foreleg, and to inform their own household that it is forbidden to eat. If they do sell it, they're required to tell the customers, and they are required to give them to the Kohanim. Afterwards, the customer can claim a refund from the butcher. In other words, if the butchers are not giving it to the Kohanim and they're selling it to the people, so you have to tell the people, I'm selling you this piece of the animal, and it has the Matanas Kahuna, so the people, they give it to the Kohanim, and they could get the money back from the butchers. This is what they set up there. I hope that, although there's prohibition, they will come to give the... Okay, we have no power to force them, but we would like them to do that. That was another interesting... And then, okay, this is also a fascinating... This is a machlokas between the Mabit and the Beis Yosef. Because many people were moving in, and now you have significant amount of people, so this is a shaila that came up, and it had to do with a Shemitah shaila. You know, this also these same shailas came up also in the 1800s, when the first aliyah, the first wave of immigrants started coming in, and they started plowing land. But the shaila here was, what do you do? Okay, just a little bit of a background. What happens on land that a goy owns, a non-Jew owns land, and the Jews would, let's say, process it? I don't know if they would rent the land to cut the grass, or they were giving it to them afterwards. So do the, on a regular year, not Shemitah, do you have to give Tumas and Maisos on that produce that's grown? And the answer is yes. Everybody agrees. Now, what happens during the year of Shemitah? Is it changed? Now, do we say, well, this is a year of Shemitah, and therefore Shemitah, there is no Trumas and Maestros to be given, because it's the year of Shemitah? Or do we say, no, since it's owned by a guy, there's no Shemitah, there's no holiness of Shemitah, but you still have to, they still will have to give Trumas and Maestros. So the Mabit held that in the year of Shemitah, they did not, the land owned by the guy, processed by the Jew, is a year of Shemitah, and you don't have to give Trumas and Maisers, and the Beis Yosef argued. And that was the back and forth between them, and I think we follow the Beis Yosef.
It kind of sounds like they were actually selling the land to the guy for the year. It doesn't say that specifically, but it kind of sounds that way, which I know is a big controversy today even.
Right, so I'm not sure if that's what they were doing for this, but but if it was owned by the guy and the Jew was working, so then I guess part of the controversy we have is that they say they sold the land to the guy, but what is it? And also, we have the ability to keep Shemitah. Now, that's only all b'di'evet, you know, like, and the bigger Kiddush Hashem, the more, you know, and every Shemitah, bigger Kiddush Hashem, more and more Moshavim or farmers have been allowing the land to, but okay, it could be that that was the case and that's what was happening, and that would be very similar to what's happening now. Or it could be just stam. What did they do? I didn't read the Tshuvas inside, but I'm just reading from this. A lot of this I got from Rabbi Irons. And he has these type. This is what he focuses on, the Jewish part of it. So just reading from these translations, it sounded like, you know, okay, these are owned by non-Jews. You know, I don't even know how much land. It would be interesting to know. I look up now how much land was owned by Jews. Were they even able to own land? I don't know. Okay, but it's, all right. Anyway, that was just another shayla that came up then. Okay, I just wanted to just as in contrast, Yerushalayim at this same time, this golden age of Spain of Sfat, when it was growing and it was so much there, Yerushalayim on the other hand was in ruins. In 1488, this is the Rav Mibatanura, the one who wrote the Perush and the Mishnayos. So he writes about Yerushalayim, 1488. Again, this is before the Spanish exiles, again, before the Ottomans came in. And he writes, Jerusalem, for the most part, is desolate and in ruins. I need not to repeat that it is not surrounded by walls at the time. Again, we mentioned walls didn't get there until 1549. And its inhabitants, I'm told, number about 4,000 families. As for the Jews, about 70 families of the poorest class have remained. There is scarcely a family that is not in want of the commonest necessities. One who has bread for a year is called rich. Among the Jewish population, there are many age-forsaken widows from Germany, Spain, Portugal, and other countries, so that there are 7 women to 1 man. I guess that's the breakdown of the community there. Jerusalem, notwithstanding its destruction, still contains four very beautiful long bazaars. I guess the Shuk. They have a nice, beautiful Shuk there, such as never seen before at the foot of Zion. When I came to Jerusalem, there was a dreadful famine. Many Jews died of hunger. They'd been seen asking for bread, and they were found, dead the next day. At present, there's only one Jewish Ashkenazic rabbi who was educated in Yerushalayim. I've never seen his equal in humility and fear. He weaves at night and learns all during the day. His food, for 6 months, he tasted no bread between Shabbos and Shabbos. His food consisting of what? Turnips and the remains of St. John's bread. I think that's buxer. It's carob, which is plentiful here after the sugar had been taken out of it. So they took the carob, took out the sugar, and it's basically worthless. So that's what he was eating. That's what he was eating. All the necessities of life, meat, wine, olive, sesame oil, can be had very cheap. Just nobody could even afford that. Soil is excellent, but it is not possible to gain a living by a branch of industry unless that of a shoemaker, weaver, goldsmith. This is Rav Avadya Bar Tanuro, who moved from Italy and became the Rav of Yerushalayim in 1488. 7 years later, now there's about, from 70 it went to about 200 families. Again, this is the year 1495, 3 years after the expulsion from Spain. 200 families who abstain from every sin and fulfill the commandments of Hashem, or people without distinction, old and young, gather together evening prayers. You get a sense of such, it's a beautiful, wonderful community in terms of from many remain after the prayer to hear the sermon of Rosh Chaya Sephardi and devote themselves for study of Mishnah and Talmud for 3 hours. Afterwards, they visit the sick and distribute alms. Chesed, Torah, beautiful. People are very benevolent, though they are poor themselves. Here in Yerushalayim, it's very difficult to earn a living. Artisans like workers in goldsmiths, weavers, tailors get hardly enough of their daily needs. Okay, Anon Writer, 1495. In the Malbach. Now, this is the Marie, this is this is the son of the Ein Yaakov, who started in Spain, went to Portugal. From Portugal, ended up in Salonika. And then after Salonika, he came to be, his father was the Ein Yaakov. He became the rabbi of Yerushalayim. This is also in the 1530s. He's probably writing this. Not only is the food of the residents of Jerusalem not sumptuous, it comes with bitterness and grief. Anyone who earns enough to buy the head of a goat and its innards for Shabbos or Yontif considers themselves as fortunate as if he was released from the house of bondage. Okay, it's just that's how very, very poor, very... I also say thank God at the time when I was sitting with honor and attainment like others of my rank in the tents of Torah in the great city of Salonika, I decided to leave there and come to Jerusalem. Through his great compassion, granted me the merit to have come. And I've been here for the past 14 years. So I think this is written in like 1538 and 1524, I think he got. In addition, he has shown his wondrous kindness to me, given the opportunity to, in my merit, two very important matters. So now I want to just go through these two matters. This is, again, he's the Rav of Yerushalayim at the time in the mid-1500s. The first was some fools and liars, may their spirit be destroyed, made false prophecies. Had I not been in the holy city at the time and calmed the people through my gentle approach and convincing arguments, the Jewish population would have been totally destroyed without even a remnant of a minion, as is well known to all of its inhabitants. What probably happened is, again, since with the upheaval of the whole world, okay, in Spain, in Portugal, and now the Ottomans conquered Eretz Yisrael, and people are moving there, and, you know, there was like a spirit of Mashiach is here, Mashiach is coming. In addition to all this, Shlomo Molcho, who we spoke about the previous week, he was inspired by David HaRuveni, and he became, he left Portugal, and he became a from Jew, and he studied and he learned, and basically he wrote a book, and in his book, his prediction, he made a few predictions, right? He was the one, I think, that predicted a flood in a certain city, and it happened.
Right.
He called it, you know, and the Pope was, oh, wow, maybe, you know. So in his book that he wrote, he said Mashiach is coming in the year about 1539 or 1540. He wrote this in a book. Okay, so, you know, people are talking about it, and there's a lot of Mashiach. Anyway, probably what happened is people came to Yerushalayim and made these false prophecies. Mashiach is here, we got to fight the Goyim, and we got to do things. And I guess the Rav Malbach was there, and he said, he calmed them down. He said, don't do it. If you start up, that's it. We're all going to be killed out. And he calmed them down. So he says that was his first major accomplishment. His second major accomplishment is going to be, which Yitzchak Hashem will talk about next week, but his second one is preventing the restoration of Smicha. Okay, we're going to learn Yitzchak Hashem next week that in Sfat, under the guidance of Yaakov Beirav, who was the leading rabbi at the time, they wanted to reinstitute the Smicha of Moshe Rabbeinu, and based on something from the Rambam. And when they decided who to give smicha to, the first one they gave it was to Yaakov Beirav. The second one they gave it was to the Ma'arach of Yerushalayim. And he said, I stand vehemently against it. And he, you know, and they were back and forth, the arguments, how could, you know, which will, Mr. Hashem, hopefully we'll cover next week. But he felt that his two crowning achievements of his life was preventing the destruction of the Yerushalayim community by these false prophets, and secondly, is preventing the smicha. Okay, and I think that is just maybe just a little bit more. This is in 15.
But don't we still have smicha that people
rabbis? The smicha that we have today is not the smicha of Moshe Rabbeinu. The smicha that was from Moshe Rabbeinu, which Mr. Shem will talk about next time, was ended during the after the Bar Kokhba rebellions. The Romans didn't allow it to continue. What we have today is only, I think, even called smicha more recently. It was called Heter Lahora, just different ways of just you. The smicha now just means you're allowed a paskin. You're trustworthy enough. You're knowledgeable enough to be a rabbi, to be paskin. But what the original smicha Moshe Rabbeinu came with it a lot more. They were able to accomplish a lot more with that smicha, which we'll talk about. So they wanted to bring back the original smicha, and the Ralbach fought against it tooth and nail, and he was largely successful because it didn't take. Rav Shmuel Bar Uzda in the mid-1500s says, more taxes and levies are placed upon the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, especially Yerushalayim. If not for the fact Jews all over the world would send money, forget it. We wouldn't be able to live. Okay, and this is also about the Yaakov Beirav. Maybe I'll add this to the next time, because we're going to talk about Rav Yaakov Beirav. Somebody was saying during one of the famines, so the yeshivas left to Egypt. And one of the yeshivas was this yeshiva of Rav Yaakov Beirav, and he says, today, in the time of Rav Yaakov Beirav, we learned more in depth in one day than we do here in an entire month. So he was bemoaning the fact that the yeshiva left because of the famine. Okay, and we're going to start with Rabbi Yaakov Beirav next week in Mirz Hashem, what his life was. He was the leader, one of the leaders, if not one of the leaders of Torah learning, of rabbinic scholarship, and he is the one that's going to try to bring back the smicha. We'll talk about him and the entire controversy in session next week. Any questions? Okay, thank you so much.